please, even though we've been talking, in the realm of talking now, we can still, with part of our mind, maintain our stability and awareness. So even though we've given a talk and maybe some back and forth, you can continue to sit with that same body awareness, breath awareness, so you don't lose that sense of being grounded. And even though now there is an experience that's a little more conceptual, and the thinking mind can be somewhat involved in that, and ears listening and the eye seeing, that's all really just taking place within this greater phenomena of just awareness. And so since we're cultivating an awareness, that sense of being grounded, which means that I don't fly off, but I'm grounded, I'm on the ground. When we're grounded, things can happen. But if we're grounded, we don't get blown over. We don't fall over. We're grounded. And even if the wind is blowing hard, and even if it rains, we still are grounded. We don't get knocked over. We don't get thrown. And so, again, it's what I was saying earlier, that please understand that what we are developing in the simplicity of our meditation, of our body awareness, of our breath awareness, of our capacity just to be aware, which means there's a mind that is, on the one hand, it is moving always in the direction of being present, always in the direction of knowing what's going on in my present experience. There is nothing in my present experience that knocks me around too much. That my awareness is large enough that whatever is occurring, positive or negative, intense, not intense, I can let it pass through me, but I do not have to be disturbed, overly thrown, overly knocked around. And whether that is just the way I respond to a sight, or to a sound, or to a smell, or to a taste, or to a thought that arises in my mind, a feeling that arises in my body, a memory that arises. In Buddhist psychology, these are all the same. These are all just phenomena, something, dharma, that is arising in my awareness. And that's all that's going on, right? If you had a very traumatic experience today, a very dramatic experience today, a very emotionally challenging experience today, where did you experience it? In your mind. That's all. If you saw a beautiful sight today, if you saw an ugly sight today, if you got good news today, if you got bad news today, if you had a good lunch today, if you had a terrible lunch today, right? If you had an easy drive over here, if you had a horrendous drive over here, right? Your experience of all that is going on where? In your mind. In your awareness. Right? And once we understand that even though the phenomena of our experience is constantly changing, right? But that which is aware can be consistent. You've understood something very profound. And it's not just a, like you win points for philosophical understanding. It means you win points because you have begun to understood the nature of reality, the nature of phenomena, and the nature of your own, most importantly, therefore, your own happiness and your own suffering. Which is really where it always comes back to. You've heard me say many times in the past, you will hear me say many times in the future. The Buddhists always say, I teach only the cessation of suffering. Everything I teach is always in relationship to that. So it's very personal. And it's very personal means it relates directly to our personal experience. And the simple desire that all of us have is to be happy. Right? I mean, that is, the Dalai Lama is always saying that. If there's one thing that unites all humankind, is that, unless people are really sick. And there are a few people like that. But, that's really off the scale. But most people, no matter what their political situation, ethnic background, religion, economic status, et cetera, they want to be happy. And they don't want to suffer. They want their loved ones to be happy. They don't want their loved ones to suffer. That's a very simple human thing. And so the Buddhist teaching, we can't make it something, something too metaphysical, too esoteric, or too divorced from ordinary human experience. Because it's interesting, if you look at the Buddha's life, and I don't know how many of you are familiar with the Buddha's life, but I think it gives you a good sense of how he expressed his enlightenment. After his enlightenment, his life was very human. Right? He basically spent his life interacting. After his great enlightenment, even though his teaching developed in India and as his community developed, he basically spent his time wandering about India, right? Well, not that. That's a big territory. In a certain area of northern India. And he was always interacting with the lay people in all the villages and towns that he came in contact with, right? Or with his communities amongst the nuns or who were around him. And he would, when he came to a town or village, he and his sangha would set up camp, usually outside of town in a grove or a park, where they would live very simply, and people would come. Right, to encounter him, to ask him questions, and if you look, especially in the Pali Canon, you get less of a feel of it in the Mahayana sutras. But if you look in the earlier, you see very personal. He's interacting with people, young people, old people, rich people, poor people, who often ask him very ordinary kind of questions about their life. As well as obviously he's interacting with people who have kind of a deeper kind of spiritual journey. He'll ask him really questions about the mind, about awakening, about true freedom from suffering. But he's also just dealing with people. There's that great story of him and with the mustard seed. Anybody take the Buddhist course recently? What? But she's a woman who had just, he comes to a town and there's this woman that just totally bereft. Her child had just died. And she was actually carrying the child around with her. It had just died a few days ago. It was a very young child. And she was, and she had heard that there was this great holy man had just kind of come to town. And she thought, I'll go to him. Maybe he can tell me how I can bring my child back to life. And so she went to the Buddha. It's a very famous account. Forgive me for not remembering her name. I want to say Maya Devi, but that was his mother. Anyway, it probably comes to me later. If you want me to call you. So here she is, carrying her child. And she hears this great saint has come. That's her village. So she goes to him and she says, she bows to him and she's holding a child. She says, can you bring my child back to life? And the Buddha says, yes, I can. And but first you have to go into your village and bring me the, you know, the famous story. You do all know this one? You know, bring me the mustard seed from the home, from a home that has not known death. When you bring me that special mustard seed, I will awaken your child. So of course you can see where this is going. So she goes into town, she knocks on the door, and she says, is this a home that has not known death? And of course everybody starts telling her, no. I've lost the death of my parents, the death of my spouse, the death of my children, the death of my siblings. And you know, and she basically goes to the village from door to door, and as she goes on, you can see she hasn't awakened. She understands something very profound about death and impermanence and life and the nature of this reality. And so when she comes back to the Buddha, no longer does she ask him for something special and unique, you know. As if, oh, you know, my child or I should be spared from having to deal with death and loss. She understands, she bowed, and she became a famous actually disciple. Name my dad. But again, that just shows you that, again, you know, because I think so much of what's transmitted in the Buddhist teachings, especially here in the West, where people are very interested in meditation and very interested in the nature of mind, very interested in really going deeply into the teachings, that we forget that the Buddhist teachings, while it has all that, it is always about helping us see clearly why, so we can be free of suffering, why, so we can be happy, so we can be at peace, so we can be calm, and so we have the capacity to really demonstrate in our own lives that kind of stability, freedom, and openness, and intelligence, so we can guide our own life skillfully, but also that we have the capacity, therefore, to be there for others, because we all know if we're not going through a difficult time right now, we certainly know somebody who is. And so therefore, if we are not using our capacity for wisdom and understanding in our own life, there will be others in our life that we can be there for and be helpful. But again, coming back to the sitting meditation, in the sitting meditation, sitting, we have a task. Our task, let's say, is what? To focus on our breath, right? To be mindful, to be present. This is our task. Right? Now, as we try to accomplish that task, what happens? Who do we run into? Anybody discover anybody that they run into on the way to accomplishing the task? Who do you run into, Mel?
Yeah.
Yes, Mel runs into Mel, right? And all of a sudden, Mel is bringing to her meditation all the things, right, that ego does. It judges, it compares, it gets frustrated, it wants things to be different, it doesn't like this, and it likes that, it wants to feel this, it doesn't want to feel that, it wants this experience to be this way and not this experience to be that way, right? All the things that, in a very small way, disturb our peace of mind in our daily life will disturb our meditation. There's nothing different. Now, we may get frustrated with that. Right? Or we may go, well, this is wonderful. Right? If I can learn to sit, just sit, in equanimity, right? And able to allow whatever arise to arise, to not have my mind disturbed in the least way, no inner struggle, no inner conflict, equanimity, peace, and at the same time cultivate mindfulness and awareness, right? In this little piece of my life, I am learning how to do it at home, at work, driving my car, shopping, reading the newspaper. You know, we have an intensive that's going on right now, it's a practice period. People in the Florida community mindfulness, and it's on the Anapanasati Sutra, which is the sutra on full awareness of the breath. And somebody emailed me today saying, it was a long email, she's in the intensive, but she said, because last, this past Monday we had a group conference call with all the participants, about 52 people, and I gave a Dharma talk on the practices for the first 4 weeks. And so she emailed me saying, and there's also readings, and there are two books to be read. So she emailed me saying, you know, when I'm doing the meditation, my mind is very even, I feel very calm, very relaxed, very clear. Is it okay if I don't read the books? Because I think I'm doing fine just for the meditation. And so when I emailed her back, I said, that's wonderful that you feel so even and calm and clear in your meditation. Please read the books with the same mind. because again, you can see we... And again, it's understandable, because a lot of us, our minds are kind of out of control, and there is a lot of often disturbance and inner conflict in our life, and we can understand why we would like to be able to carve out a little bit of sanity, a little island of peace and calm, right, where we can kind of hide out, right, from the winds of impermanence. In life. And that's perfectly understandable, and that's probably in the early stages of practice not a bad idea, right? It's sort of like the way I see it is, you know, if your ship, not from shipwreck, but if your ship went down, right, and you're out there in the middle of the ocean, you know, in a little rowboat, you know, with the winds and the waves, even to just come across a tiny little island, you know, 15 feet by 15 feet, right, where you can rest, it's probably wonderful. but it's not the solution. Being alone on a desert island, 15 by 15, may present its own problems. So, well, that desire to carve out that little bit of peace, it unfortunately becomes simply kind of an escape, escapism. But also it means that my inner peace is very fragile, right? Because it only arises under these very controlled conditions. And unfortunately, or fortunately actually, most of us, our lives unfold in very uncontrollable conditions, where things are changing all the time. And there are lots of stresses and strains. So we must, because of the nature of our life, develop the capacity to maintain our groundedness, to maintain our center, to maintain our calmness in the midst of activity. Maintain calmness and clarity in the midst of inactivity is not that hard, right? But when things begin to move a little bit, and not to get sucked in, is the challenge. You know, the analogy often is that a certain kind of tree. And there are certain kind of trees that are very rigid. When a strong wind comes through, they snap. They break. But those very flexible trees, and we know we have them in Florida, you know, such as palm trees, we know that they have an incredible capacity, you know, and you see the pictures during hurricanes, right? They almost have the capacity almost to be turned almost to the ground, right? And yet, what? When the hurricane passed, up they come. Why? Because they're rooted. They're grounded. And we want that same capacity. But because, you know, we are not trees, we need different kind of roots. And so the roots that we are cultivating in our meditation is roots that are rooted in awareness, roots that are rooted in understanding. It's very important. This is why we say that this is a meditative path, but this is also a path of understanding and compassion. Because when we understand what's going on, we then will tend not to grasp or get overly involved in things that we know are inherently unstable. So that understanding of phenomena also keeps us from getting knocked over, because we don't lunge after things. You know, most people, we're just very reactive. So we're always jumping after this one, jumping after that, grabbing onto this, grabbing onto that. And then we end up, you know, it's like, what's that thing about the guy and the horse? You know, somebody's racing by on a horse, and somebody shouts out, "Where are you going?" And the guy points to the horse and says, "I don't know, ask him." You know, I think that's kind of us with our emotions, with our reactive, habitual ways of reacting. We're sort of just along for the ride. And so it's through our understanding of what that's about, and again, by deepening through the practice of meditation and mindfulness, to develop a ground and a base, and an inner calmness and an inner centeredness, one can then have the capacity of moving through the ups and downs and changes of life. Again, with greater happiness, calmness, stability. Any questions about that? This is very important. Anybody disagree? Just aren't clear about in their own life how to deal with certain types of situations? Not to how to stay grounded, not to get sucked in. I mean, don't feel embarrassed or shy if it's not clear.
I have a question.
Yes.
I understand the concept of being grounded, but it seems kind of there could be some of the subtle difference between, like, okay, I'm here, I'm grounded, and then phenomenon is out here.
Mm-hmm.
Or, okay, I'm just naturally kind of living my life, things are happening. But it seems like those are two different states, a little bit.
Okay, and what you want to do is bring them together. I mean, this is, you know, daily life is it. We don't have a life other than our daily life, do we? Do we? I mean, that's our life. There's no other life but our daily life. Our daily life is what each of us do every day. That is our life. There is no awakening, there is no enlightenment outside of our daily life. This is like the great, this is one of the great thrusts of Zen. Because we know that a more kind of religious or temple-based kind of religion goes, what? It's over there. It's in the temple, it's in the meditation hall. That's where awakening is, right? And this is just what? The daily grind, you know, somehow put up with, right? Or we know there are some religions which go, you know, just put up with this. It's a lot of suffering, put up in this, but you'll be rewarded in the hereafter.
Right.
Again, like this is just something, you know, that gets in the way of where we want to go. But Zen says, no, this very, you know, in Hakuin Zenji song of Zen, he says, this very body is the body of Buddha. This very place is the Pure Land. Pure Land of Buddhism is like heaven. This very body is the body of Buddha. So for those of you who think that this is the body of the Buddha, it's not the body of the Buddha. You can only find the body of the Buddha within your own body. That's where the Buddha resides. Which is waiting for you to awaken to. In this very place, you know, that's, you know, when the doors of perception are cleansed, one will see. So we don't want, you know, so when you talk about awareness and groundedness and all that, where does that manifest? It manifests in life. It's not as if, you know, there's your awareness and your groundedness as kind of entities, and then there's your daily life. Your groundedness, your calmness, your awareness only manifests in your moment-to-moment living. And so that's why, you know, we don't want to mistake and think that coming to meditation on Thursday night is the practice of Buddhism. It's part of the practice. But the practice of Buddhism manifests in our daily life. Our daily life is everything that arises. Everything. Once we understand that, then we realize that practice is endless. Or we could say practice is continuous. As long as we are alive, we will practice. What do we practice? Being present, being aware, being open, being spacious, being kind, compassionate. I mean, these are all the things that we are practicing moment to moment. No matter where we go and what we do. It becomes kind of easy. And then we feel unified. A lot of times people feel like they're, you know, everybody feels like they're a multiple personality. I'm one kind of person when I'm home, and I'm one kind of person at work, and I'm one kind of person in the community, and I'm one kind of person when I'm alone by myself and nobody can see me. I'm one kind of person when I'm with this people, and I'm one kind of person when this, you know, no wonder we feel kind of split. Right? But when you develop an authentic relationship with yourself, right, and your practice of being yourself is continuous, then you feel whole. There's a wholeness, there's an integration that is naturally present. Yes, Mr. Martinez, we have a question.
Well, it's more about...
By the way, there was a very nice picture of Rick in the St. Pete Times. There, I was opened it up, there he was.
Well, you know, my observation or my feeling really kind of it fits right with the words that you're sharing with us, in that sometimes I struggle with my practice at home, and coming to Thursday night meditation seems to strengthen my daily practice, seems to invigorate it, reinvigorate it, seems to, I miss not being here. And when I do come, I feel much more in touch with my practice at home. So that's just an observation that I had, or a feeling. That I experience. And so I go through my meditation attempts.
Yes.
At home, sometimes it's successful, but there's nothing special that about coming here that really adds to my
Again, I think what you're saying is something we all experience. I mean, we, you know, there is something about the collective energy of being with like-minded people. There's something about sitting together with other people. And again, you know, we are taking the time here to sit together, breathe together, bring out the best in each other, listen to the Dharma, share the Dharma.
Right.
This is ideal. But having said that, you know, the other thing we can do at home is do our best to recreate it. So what do I think? You know, it's sort of, I think it's nice to have at home a special place for you. Like a little, if you could have a whole room, great. But even just a little corner, right? Where you might have your cushion, you might have your little altar, a Buddha, or flowers, or, you know, Christ, I mean, whatever you want, or, right? A little incense, a candle. Again, you know, just because it creates a setting, you know? I think that can often be helpful. I think the same way to kind of build it into your daily life, you know what I mean? The same way. You know, this is always 7 to 9 on Thursday night. So it doesn't just happen. In the same way, if we have a rhythm to our day, so we sit for 20 minutes or 30 minutes or 45 minutes in the morning, and again, you know, just the same way here, we can come in, we can bow, we can sit. We can just do the same, you know. I mean, one of the reasons that, at least when I'm here, you know, I always do that kind of centering meditation first, like a guided meditation early on. Hopefully, you'll learn, you know, those who've been coming a while will learn. You know what I mean, or variation. I mean, I'm just kind of making it up as I go. But you'll understand it, and you'll do the same thing in your own practice, right? You know, sometimes you get up in the morning, you have to sleep, you go, you sit on your cushion. You know, and it's just saying, you know, again, I would get up in the morning, make sure you're awake, do a little exercise, have a cup of tea, have a cup of coffee, whatever you have, kind of, you know, freshen yourself, wake up, right? When you're ready, go sit. But again, in the same way, kind of ground yourself and establish your presence and always be clear about what am I doing? What is my practice? What is my meditation? That's very important before you start. The other thing I think, especially, you know, the points you make are good, Rick, is, you know, spending a moment or five just, you know, meditating on impermanence, meditating on death, meditating on, you know, spending a moment just meditating on impermanence, meditating on death. Death can come at any moment. Just kind of reflective on the nature of change and impermanence of the body, sickness, old age, and death, the five remembrances. I mean, these kinds of things. Reminding yourself, why am I practicing? Right? You know, why am I crossing my legs? Well, you know, it may be because not this, but because of, you know, I know that if I do not ground myself, and if I do not have a place within me that is calm and clear, that it's very easy for me to get, you know. I mean, when I talk about getting swept away by daily life, we're talking about what everybody else calls what? Stress. You know, I mean, there's a word. People are stressed. What does that mean, people are stressed? That people are stressed out by what? By their life. Right? By the activities of their life. Where does stress occur? Stress occurs in the body and the mind. The stressed out person is someone who's stressed within their body and stressed within their mind. If that's one of the reasons that we have brought ourselves to the practice, then take a moment before you do your meditation to remind yourself, Because, again, this mind tends to go on automatic pilot. And left to its own devices, it will just continue to do the same stuff it's always done. What practice is about is very consciously deciding very personally, I want to move my life in a different direction. I mean, I think a wonderful thing to do, especially if you're a busy person and your day is very active with lots of things, incorporating your practice. Let's say you're sitting for 20 or 30 minutes in the morning, and let's say you are, to some degree or another, calming and quieting and unifying the mind. You know, spend a few minutes just visualizing your day, right? And think about, how am I going to carry, how do I want to carry this practice with me into the reality of my day? I think it's very important. Because, you know, if we don't, we're going to get up from our meditation, we're going to walk out the door, we're going to get the first phone call, the first this, the first that, and what? Off and run. And then you're going to crawl in the door at night. You know, licking our wounds from the day. Right, Ross? It's funny, but it contrasts. It is the nature of our habitual mind that if we're not very conscious, right, of what our practice is, and not very conscious of how we want it to manifest during the day, the force of the day, the force of our habit forces, plus the just activity, busyness of the day, you put that together, and what's going to happen? Same old, same old. You know, there's no mystery. If we want the day to be different, then I think we have to be somewhat planful. You have to be very clear in the morning. You know, what am I going to do today to maintain my mind? You know, am I going to stop and just come back to my breath every 10 minutes? It just take 30 seconds, you know? Is that what I'm going to do? Am I going to, if you have a cubicle or an office door, am I going to close it a couple of times a day and just take 5 or 10 minutes just to breathe? Am I going to make a commitment that every time I have a phone call, I'm going to take 3 breaths before I pick it up? 3 mindful breaths. Huh? Am I going to take 3 mindful breaths after I put it down, before I go on to my next thing? You see what I'm saying? I think if we kind of have a conscious plan of how we're going to be building in these mindful transition points or breaks or little bells of mindfulness during the day, that's what we have to begin to build in. Or you'll be like you say, I'll have my meditation practice, my mindfulness, and then I'll have my everyday. And they'll be like 2 different universes. We want to bring them together. Because again, most of us, if we look at how we spend our life, all right, we are spending very little part of our life. All right, Jim, how much of your life do you spend on the cushion? And how much does you spend on your life doing things? Well, no comparison. So, I mean, if I think my practice is just what I do in the cushion, right, can you see it'll never really get me anywhere? And I'll be frustrated. Because the truth is, you know, 95% of my day is taking place in the world of activity. So this is, maybe I'm belaboring the point tonight, but I think it's just very simple but very key, because we do have this notion that meditation is something connected to the cushion. You know, like if I don't have the cushion, right? But that's, you know, just kind of the base point. This is where we recharge the battery. You know, like with the rechargeable batteries, right? You get that little recharger, right? But you only you don't keep the batteries always in the recharger, right? You put them into your phone or your flashlight, you know, so they can be active and do something. Right? So this is our charger, right? But then, you know, once we're charged, you know, we go out and we do what we do. So what we want to do is begin to take this new kind of energy we're developing, the energy of mindfulness, the energy of awareness, the energy of openness, the energy of non-resistance, the energy of acceptance, the energy of seeing clearly, the energy of non-grasping, all these dharmic energies, right, that we're cultivating. We want to take them with us. Because again, you know, like Jim was just saying, if I'm only happy and peaceful when I'm on this cushion, you know, and I'm kind of stressed and out of sorts and miserable, you know, and the other 95% of my life, well, I mean, I guess it's nice to have that 5%. I mean, I'm not, you know, but can you see? It's ultimately not going to work. Again, we are linked. We are not hermits. We do not live in monasteries. We do not live in retreat centers. We're not meditating 12, 14 hours a day, right? So to follow a teaching that was developed for people living that kind of lifestyle is foolish, and it's actually kind of destructive. The Buddha and the teachers have all given very clear teachings for lay people that give us the capacity of being as awake and enlightened as anybody else, but they're just different teachings because of the nature of our life. And again, I guess I'd also say to you, Rick, it will be different. You know, I mean, it's sort of like when people come on retreat, you know, 3-day retreats, 4-day retreats, 7-day retreats, 10-day retreats, 30-day retreats. You know, you do, you know, reach a deep state of clarity, openness, freedom, right? That's quite wonderful. And many people get frustrated because when they go back home in their life, you know, they don't carry it. Well, you know, you can't carry this, right? Because you're entering a world of activity, stimulation. You know, if anybody's ever been on a long-term retreat, if anything, they're very boring, right? I mean, there's nothing going on. There's not a lot of stimulation, which is good, because the focus is how can I work on my practice, you know, my meditation practice in ideal conditions. But when we return to daily life with all the activities and the ups and downs, to think you're going to have the same kind of clarity, the same kind of calmness, the same kind of openness, the same, you won't. But that doesn't mean you have to go all the way back down to, you know, to misery again. You can find a nice, even keel place. Any other questions? Practice in daily life. Everything clear? Yes. Yeah. What did you mean?
No.
Yes.
This will not be normalized very well, but another kind of split that I'm experiencing is awareness is kind of centered in me, but I feel compassion is outward directed. And that manifests in there's two directions. And I think that mindfulness, for me personally, I would like to think, is a vehicle for compassion development. But I get the sense of they're going in different directions.
That's an interesting. Did everybody hear that? So he's sort of saying, kind of, there's awareness, which is kind of one thing, and it seems to be very much here. And then there's compassion, which kind of is a moving out towards, and they don't seem to be connected, or they kind of are separate.
He's going in different directions.
He's going different directions. So. to have awareness is always to be aware of something. There are times in meditation one can kind of be aware of awareness, which is kind of a non-directive, non-conceptual kind of, it's a meditative state. But as we move about the world, we will encounter phenomena. Things will arise in our awareness. We'll be aware of something. Be aware of a thought. Be aware of a feeling. Be aware of a memory. Be aware of a person. Be aware of, all kinds of things. A flower, a tree, right? We'll be aware of something. So awareness is not just static. Awareness is active. And it incorporates every experience. Now, compassion is that capacity to be aware or mindful of suffering. Not as if, awareness is also aware of happiness. Awareness in and of itself is neutral. Awareness is just is. But then, we're aware of all different kinds of things. So the capacity to be aware of suffering is something that is very human. Why? Because suffering seems to be very much part of the human condition, without going into all the reasons. And the encounter of awareness with suffering is boundless in the sense that we can be aware of our own suffering, or we can be aware of the suffering of others. The wonderful thing about awareness is there's a lot of clarity in awareness. So one is able to really see very deeply and clearly the suffering of another human being, or the happiness of another. And that if the awareness is able to flow freely, which means it is not contaminated by a duality of, me over here and you over there, or lots of thoughts or conceptualizations or projections or all that stuff. Right. The encounter with suffering is very pure. And naturally, one feels it. And I think naturally and spontaneously, one will want to do something about it. Especially as one's own experience is less self-centered, less egocentric. We know that. This is not just a conceptual or religious or moral. Because I know Fred, right? Because if I identify with myself, right, when Fred is suffering, spontaneously, what do I want to do? Alleviate his suffering, right? I don't have to think about it. If Fred is hungry, I want to get him some food, right? Right? If Fred has a hurt in his arm, the other arm will just reach out and massage it. Right? There's no thought there, is there? So we know that when awareness becomes aware of suffering, it naturally responds. As the Zen master says, he says it's like in the night. It's a wonderful koan. He says it's in the night when you're asleep and your head has fallen off the pillow. Even in your sleep, your hand reaches out and pulls the pillow back under your head. That's the kind of analogy of the spontaneous nature of compassion. So in that same way, when we, our awareness touches our own suffering, and it's able to be very present to it, there is this spontaneous desire to do something about it, to help. In the same way as our awareness touches the suffering of others when we come in contact with it, just naturally, if there's no boundaries, we will want to help. So I think if we are, you know, allowing our awareness not just to be a non-conceptual meditative experience, but to be something that we bring to all our contact with phenomena, especially suffering. Again, because I say especially suffering, because we often are uncomfortable with suffering, our own, others. There's often uncomfortable feelings, pain involved, or often, you know, we think we got to do something, we don't know what to do, so we're, you know, there's just lots of stuff we have around it. But if we don't have any stuff around it, it can be a, I think the capacity to be there and be present to another's suffering, and to do one's best to be present to them and offer them some help in any way we can, I think it's one of the most wonderful things about being a human being. I don't know about you. No. I mean, I think when we are able to help another human being, right, in any way, we feel good, don't we? What? Yeah, it's love, or isn't it? I mean, but it's, you know what I mean? So this is very much part of the practice. Is that? So why don't we stop here? I wanted to say something. I see Rick has walked in about that. Probably most people don't know about it. People who are members of the Far Eastern Mindfulness and are on, I've been sending a lot of information about that out. I really haven't been sending it out to our general email list. Bát Na is the Vietnamese word for prajna, wisdom. And most of you know that you know, we practice in the tradition of Thich Nhat Hanh, and he's Vietnamese. And, I mean, I won't go into his whole story. He was in exile for many years. But about 3-4 years ago, was invited back by the Vietnamese communist government. After many, many years of exile and lots of politics, was invited back. And he's had 3 very successful tours that lasted for months, gave teachings all over the place, thousands, tens of thousands of people came, gave talks to Communist Party cadres, I mean, all kinds of things. But including which, he was invited to set up some temples to train in his type of engaged Buddhism. One of the temples that he was given to use was a temple called Prajna Temple, or Bát Na. But because of all kinds of reasons, political, I mean, we can go into it, and his international followers also spent $1 million because they would have the days of mindfulness, 5-10,000 people. You know, 5-10,000 people coming for a retreat. I mean, it was such a yearning for his teaching, and they were able to raise money and build a very nice facility. But for whatever reason, political or whatever factions within the communist government, Buddhist establishment or whatever, his followers were told they had to leave. This was maybe months ago. And then pressure got up. There was riot, violence. Mobs would come, police would stand by. Many people think the mob were police directed, and they were beaten, harassed, et cetera, et cetera. And it all came to culmination about a week ago when they were dragged out. The mob came, police came, but the place was destroyed, windows all broken, doors broken down. They're dragged out, beaten, taken away. But they all managed to regroup in another temple, I don't know how many miles away, but they took refuge. And right now, once again, the government is harassing them, threatening them.
I think it was the church.
What?
I think it was the Catholic church.
No, it was, no. Actually, what it was it is a Buddhist temple. But what it's been saying is that, it's interesting, there is a local Catholic church that has stood with them and offered their space. I don't believe it's the latest I've heard that they've gone there. But it's and there are other things going. There have been delegations of elders, Buddhists in that county that have written something to the government. So, and there was a letter from other young monks and nuns and other things to the government. So there's, anyhow, there's all kinds of stuff going on. But it's obviously a very difficult situation. And I will send something out tomorrow to our whole email list, acquainting people with it, the situation. But what I'm coming to is Plum Village community has asked the various communities around the world to do anything they can to bring attention to this, and so they're asking to kind of hold public meditation, etc. And there's a couple of Vietnamese Buddhists I know here in Tampa who contacted me because I've been in contact with them, and they're in contact with the local Buddhist temples and trying to find a space this weekend on Saturday or Sunday to hold some sort of meditation, prayer, meditation meeting for this situation, to bring attention to it and to direct our energy toward this situation so it can be resolved peacefully. So we will send out information. I know Rick's involved with the Buddhist Peace Fellowship. When we find a place, we can let you know, and you can get out the word. So I just wanted to let you know. If you are interested, I mean, at this point, you can just Google Thich Nhat Hanh, Prajna Temple, Bat Nha, and all kinds of things come up, because there's New York Times and AP and other people that are writing articles about it. But there is a website called Help Bat Nha, Bat Nha, BATNHA, Bat Nha, Help Bat Nha. And that is a website, very interesting. I mean, reports. I mean, one of the things the police did was they took away all their cell phones, because up to then, I mean, you almost were getting instant messaging. You know, I mean, it would be like the police have now entered so and so. The police have just dragged out so and so. They've just taken away so and so. I mean, it'd be instantaneous, as well as there'd be pictures. So the police are getting sophisticated and supposedly when the first thing they did is they confiscated all the cell phones and they threw water on everybody's computer. But obviously things are still getting out. So that's the Batna situation. Sad situation. There are about 400 monks and nuns, and most of them are young, like between 18 and 25. Most of them, you know, Buddhism in Vietnam is very traditional, very temple-based, and not very popular among young people for that reason. But the Thich Nhat Hanh is that because of the type of engaged Buddhism, and very much about Buddhism, well, we're talking in daily life, he's had a tremendous effect on those that have come in contact with him. So he's attracted many, many young people. I mean, I don't know, 500, 1,000, I don't know how many monks and nuns he's ordained, young ones. I mean, and the problem is more, there's no space to train them. I mean, there's so many thousands who want to follow. So these are all, you know, young monks and nuns. They've been subject now, at least very heavily since June. They've had no electricity, no water. You know, there's been these physical abuse. And yet they have remained there, meditating, practicing, showing no animosity, you know, resisting nonviolently. It's been a very profound experience.